Thank you for coming to the class that I was asked to give on Bhagavad Gita 11:50 and 51. Well, it seems like it's fixed since previous years when it would freak out and make all kinds of big noises and stop and explode and all kinds of things. Seems like progress is being made. Okay, I guess we can chant together 50 and then I'll read the purport, and then I'll just keep reading, going ahead to 51, the verse and the purport, and then we'll have some discussion. Sanjaya Uvacha Idyarjunam Vasudhavitvastatokva Svakam Lupam Darshayam Asabhuyaham Aspashyam asachabitamena Bhutva punak somya vapur mahatma Sanjaya uvacha Idyarjunam vasudevas tatokpa Svakam rupam darshayam asabhuyaha Ashvashyam asha chabitamena Budva punak somya vapur mahatma Ityarjunam vasudevas tatokva Svakam rupam darshyam asabhuyaha Ashvashya asha chabitamena Budva punak somya vapur mahatma Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Sanjaya said to Dhritarashtra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, having spoken thus to Arjuna, displayed His real four-arm form, and at last showed His two-arm form, thus encouraging the fearful Arjuna. Horrible. It's inspiring to have you here in the class. Keep me on my toes. Please repeat. Sanjaya said to Dhritarashtra, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, having spoken thus to Arjuna, displayed His real four-arm form, and at last showed His two-arm form, thus encouraging the fearful Arjuna. Purport. When Krishna appeared as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki, He first of all appeared as four-armed Narayan, but when He was requested by His parents, He transformed Himself into an ordinary child in appearance. Similarly, Krishna knew that Arjuna was not interested in seeing a four-armed form, but since Arjuna asked to see this four-arm form, Krishna also showed him this form again, and then showed himself in His two-handed form. The word Somya Vapu is very significant. Somya Vapu is a very beautiful form. It is known as the most beautiful form. When He was present, everyone was attracted simply by Krishna's form, and because Krishna is the director of the universe, He just banished the fear of Arjuna, His devotee, and showed him again His beautiful form of Krishna. In the Brahma Sangita 5:38, it is stated, Preman Jananchurita Bhakti Valochanena, only a person whose eyes are smeared with the ointment of love can see the beautiful form of Sri Krishna. Text 51, I'll just read through myself. Arjuna Uvacha. Tisvedam manusam rupam tava somyam janardanam idanim asmi samvritaha sacheta prakritim kataha. When Arjuna thus saw Krishna in his original form, he said, "O Janardhan, seeing this human-like form, so very beautiful, I am now composed in mind, and I am restored to my original nature." Manusam, human-like. Purport. Here the words Manusam Rupam clearly indicate the Supreme Personality of Godhead to be originally two-handed. Those who deride Krishna as if he were an ordinary person are shown here to be ignorant of his divine nature. If Krishna is like an ordinary human being, then how is it possible for him to show the universal form and again show the four-handed Narayan form? So it is very clearly stated in Bhagavad Gita that one who thinks that Krishna is an ordinary person and who misguides the reader by claiming that it is the impersonal Brahman within Krishna speaking is doing the greatest injustice. The worst injustice, we could say. Krishna has actually shown his universal form and his four-handed Vishnu form. So how can he be an ordinary human being? A pure devotee is not confused by misguiding commentaries on Bhagavad Gita because he knows what is what. The original verses of Bhagavad Gita are as clear as the sun. They do not require lamplight from foolish commentators. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jananjana Shalakya Chakshu Militam Yena Tasmay Shri Gurave Namaha. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So the scope of today's lecture will be, of course, something on the two texts that we read. It'll be referring to the chapter as a whole, the whole idea of the universal form. And then, as I tend to do in my particular style, we can say, is some philosophical understanding we can discuss. Of course, the philosophical aspect will come up throughout the lecture. There will always be some philosophy will be there. So those of us who are a little philosophical, we might pick up on the fact that Srila Prabhupada mentioned that he displayed his real forearm form. So what does that mean, real forearm form? What do we mean by real? What do we mean by reality? So we can cover that whole topic in 3 minutes, right? This is a field of philosophy. The technical term is ontology. What does it mean to be? It even covers such things as... I used to work in a foreign bookstore, books of all different languages, in Harvard University, right near Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in 1968-69. And I noticed one book intrigued me called The Meaning of Meaning. Don't worry, there wasn't another book called The Meaning of Meaning of Meaning and The Meaning of Meaning of Meaning. But even just The Meaning of Meaning, people think about these things. And it sounds, some people would think this is ridiculous, but actually it means a person is thoughtful. They're questioning the basic assumptions that underlie our language, underlie our life, like that. So a simple answer, of course, you can answer very simply that we've already heard that the universal form is more or less imaginary. So we can just say, relative to the universal form, the forearm form is real. Like in America, that we used to say to each other, hey man, are you for real? We used to say like that. And now I don't think anyone does like that, but... But there's but still, it was still, you could say, well, okay, so it's more real. So is real relative? Is it, or is there some actual final absolute reality, which is the source of all reality, which is actually real? Remember in Srimad Bhagavatam, what is the greatest good for all people described at the very beginning of Bhagavatam in the second text? Dejam vastavam asta vastu shivadam. The greatest good for all people is to distinguish reality from illusion, substance from shadow. This has been going on a long time. An interesting question that we can throw out there for the in the internet for all the trillions, billions, or at least millions of viewers out there. Is it a level playing field? Are these kind of questions a level playing field? You all know what it means to be a level playing field. It means it's not that, like right now, it's not a level playing field. I'm the speaker, you're listening, and then you can ask questions in a certain format. The other day, Acharya Prabhu, he was speaking, I was listening. So it's not a level playing field. It's there's some distinction. But if we have a round table discussion, it's like a level playing field. I'm just trying to take into account that except for Acharya Prabhu and myself, there's probably nobody else except Mother Parvati, who is a native English speaker here, so I'm not assuming that you know these expressions, what they mean. But is it a level playing field, these questions that came up, you know, Plato and substance and shadow and all the great names in philosophy over the years, the centuries. Is it the fact that science has advanced so much and can control nature so much and we can travel in jet planes and talk on the internet? Does that mean that people's philosophical ideas before that happened are to be sort of tolerated and maybe we might find them amusing? No, I would say philosophy is a level playing field. It's not that Socrates is now antiquated and, you know, he's just like obsolete because now we have the internet. Have the internet or not have the internet? Prabhupada said, Punar Musika Bhava. In one moment, everything could be finished. And it's getting finished. A lot of things are getting finished now, faster than we may realize, even in the big countries. Again, become a mouse. But, all right, so I would say it is a level playing field. Philosophical discussions have nothing to do with whether or not you've managed to lord it over better, the material nature. Philosophical discussion means, is that really what we should be doing? In Vedic culture, the answer was no. It's not really the program for the conditioned soul. There's some scope for it because of the conditioned natures, but the paradigm is one where everything had, at least was leading toward the transcendental goal. Just some very general comments. So real. Real. Real, what is the definition? Bhagavad Gita makes it so simple. I say this all the time, but so many devotees, they don't remember if I said it or they never heard me say it. Or maybe you already... But what is how does Bhagavad Gita, how does one verse in Bhagavad Gita give the whole ontology at once? The whole, remember what I said, ontology means the study of what does it mean to exist, what is being. One verse in Bhagavad Gita just says it all, finished.
Are you asking?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Nashato vijite bhavo, nabhavo vijite sataha, ubayor apidishtonta, stvaniya stattva darshi vihi. We're on the same page. In fact, it's 2:16. In fact, we're on the same page, and that page is literally in Bhagavad Gita, page 86. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, that's in brackets. It's an example of something that doesn't really exist. Not the only thing that doesn't really exist. Of the non-existent, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. Bas, it's finished. Bhagavad Gita is only 700 verses, but you can go through hundreds and hundreds of books in Western philosophy, and they kind of like trying to approach 2:16, chapter 2, text 16. Very important verse. 16:16. So that gives us at least some inkling of that. In other words, Krishna's form, his real form, means that it's not. Now the universal form, we won't say it's exactly material. There's one place where Prabhupada says it's a spiritual form. Well, it's spiritual because it's arranged by Krishna. But it's more or less imaginary. It's not more imaginary than the Empire State Building. You see? The Empire State Building is not more unreal or more... In other words, universal form is just that you see everything all at once, which is a more objective vision of the universe. And one thing you see is the kala rupa, the form of destruction, starting with verse 19 of this chapter. That's the terrifying aspect of the universal form. That wasn't there in the form displayed to Duryodhana. Maybe Duryodhana would have come more to his senses if he would have seen the universal form, including that aspect. But at the beginning of the chapter, we hear it's beautiful, it's opulent, it's gorgeous, it's even smells good, so many perfumes, everything is there. But then when you get to verse 19, Anadi Madhyantam Anantavirjam Anantabahum Shashishuryanetram Pasyami Tvam Drisht, what is it? Drisht, Dipta Hutasavatram Svateja Savishvam Itam Tapantam. He's burning the whole universe by this glaring effulgence. No beginning, no middle, no end. Then it starts to get scary. Let me just move on a little bit. The sequence is the same, and the principle of how nicely the Lord reciprocates with his devotee and their abhista. Two references, 11.5.33 and Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam. Okay, the next topic, little topic, but very deep, is called the abhista, abhistas. We glorify Srila Rupa Goswami that he knew the abhista of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam, abhista. What is abhista? Abhista is the innermost ire in the heart. Rupa Goswami, it's confirmed in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he can detect, he can feel the inner desire of the Lord. And the Lord also knows the inner desire of the Lord also knows the inner desire of the devotees. You can walk in this empty space here, if you like, you can come forward. Mataji is suggesting, cordially inviting you to come forward or something. And make better use of this space. Okay. How does this refer to the verse in purport? What I was thinking of here is Prabhupada's making a parallel and a comparison between Vasudeva Devaki when Krishna appeared first in also Forearm form. That's described very vividly in Srimad Bhagavatam, the beginning of the 10th canto. Very beautiful. He already had full hair. He had Kaustubha, Vaidurya jewel, and bracelets and anklets and this and that. And it was very gorgeous. And it was forearm form. But Devaki did not like. She did not like. Because she had some fear that Kamsa would disturb and try to kill. On the one hand, she was aware this is God. But at the same time, she had that motherly instinct. And she wanted to protect her son, even though her son was quite well endowed, we can say, with all power and opulence and beauty. So, okay, the Lord, he accepted, okay, as you like. He just became a shishu, became like a baby boy, beautiful baby boy, but still not so threatening and so prominent as the forearm form. So Prabhupada is comparing that with Arjuna's not really. Now, how do we make sense of this? Because we hear the translation a few verses back. How does it go? Puvam Rishito. Dishtva Vayena cha pravya pitam manome. Arjuna is saying, I'm very thrilled. This form, which I've never seen before, it's great. It's really great. Adrishta purvam rishitos midrishtva vayena cha pravya pitam manome. Tat eva me darshya deva rupam prashida devesha jigani vasha. My mind is disturbed by fear, Arjuna is saying, so please bestow your grace upon me and reveal again your form as the personality of Godhead. And then Arjuna even goes on to say, he's specifying forearms, kiritinam gajanam chakra hastam, ishtamitvam drashtam aham tataiva, etc. And he says, each chamitvam, and then the translation is, I long to see you in that form. Okay, now fast forward to today's verse. And Prabhupada saying that Krishna knew that Arjuna did not want to see that form. So, like when we read things like this, it forces us to become thoughtful and think a little bit deeper. The same thing could be said at the beginning of the chapter when Arjuna also said, Ichchami, I want to see that form. He already got the Vibhuti Yogas, many of them, about 72 or so in chapter 10. And then he wanted to see how you pervade the universe, like all at once. I mean, how do you actually enter the universe? That's what I want to see now. If you think I'm capable of seeing it, please reveal that to me, your great form, universal form. So, it sounded like Arjuna wanted it, but actually his avista, his innermost desire, was not really that, but Arjuna was sacrificing a little his own desire and requesting it because Arjuna is compassionate. In fact, because he's so compassionate, he didn't want to fight the battle of Kurukshetra at the beginning. So he's compassionate. He's thinking of us. So as you probably heard a number of times in the course of this whole chapter, he requested universal form so that in the future there would be a test, or at least it wouldn't be taken so cheaply, somebody claiming to be God. At least show your universal form. So in the same way, he's requesting the forearm form. We could say, well, maybe Arjuna also did want it, at least as a relief from seeing the universal form. But it was also for our benefit, because what to speak of displaying universal form. In other words, you want to see that Krishna and also Vishnu are actually the source of the universal form. Arjuna wanted to become very clear like that. So the idea of the universal form, like consolidating itself into the forearm form, which is real in a deep sense. We're also real, by the way, in case you just want to reassure everybody that we're real. We're not these bodies, but we're real. Then, going a step further, going to Shaumyavapu, which brings us to how Bhagavad Gita takes us to real bhakti, this idea of love. And as Prabhupada says in the purport, it's only by love that Krishna will reveal that especially beautiful form. And shomya is sometimes translated as gentle also, a very gentle form. Forearm form, it's reassuring. But shomya is not only reassuring, it's delightful. And just a festival for the eyes, and for the heart. There's also that reference in the 11th canto, Deyam Sada Pariganam Ja Avishtadoham, that Krishna, that the Lord, the lotus feet of the Lord fulfill the innermost desire of the devotee. Rupa Goswami, he knew the innermost desire of Lord Chaitanya, but the Lord also knows our own innermost desire. So the last sentence of the purport brings us to another philosophical concern called knowledge. Keep it simple, knowledge. Theory of knowledge. Otherwise known as epistemology. It's not such a, I mean, some of you know that word, epistemology. The purport to 50. Premanjana charita bhakti valochanena. Only a person whose eyes are smeared with the ointment of love can see the beautiful form of Krishna. But the two go together. The philosophy of the idea of real, of ontology, of implying, in other words, kind of provoking in us a sense of thinking about what does this mean to be real, and then how do we know things? If reality is beyond the range of the senses, then the epistemic or epistemological implication, now we have a third English speaker, Mahaprabhu Prabhu, let's come. I'm not going to neglect the rest of you, don't worry. And if I say something and I use some language and you just don't understand, don't hesitate to raise your hand. If I don't see you, scream. Let me know and I'll try to use other language. If reality is beyond the range of the senses, then Shabda is certainly implied. So depending on your ontology, your epistemological conclusion will vary. In other words, depending upon what is real, where is reality? If reality is it the phenomena or is it the noumena? Is it just the appearances of things? Is it the shadow or is it the actual substance? Where is reality? So if reality is not just what things appear to be, but what is the source of those appearances, and in Western philosophy, there have been philosophers that have recognized that we're really not getting it. We're really not seeing whatever is act. The things in themselves elude our vision. And in Vedic and Bhagavatam, it's also there. They're called tanmatras. The actual bhuti, mahabhutani, the elements, we're not actually seeing even so-called material reality. We're just seeing the sense objects. They expand into the tanmatras. They're sense objects. So we're really not connecting with whatever is actually out there. Whatever is actually out there is Krishna. Krishna, Krishna's energies. And the advanced devotees, therefore he sees Krishna everywhere. Because he's not just depending upon sense perception. But sense perception and mental speculation, they just keep us locked up within this very, very relatively, well, very limited arena of the interaction of the senses and their objects. Of course, if our goal is sense gratification, then we'll be quite content to contain ourselves within that arena, because that's enough world for us. Happiness in the mode of passion doesn't require transcendence until it's too late, or something like that. So the point I'm getting at is that we need Shabda. We need to hear from authority. We need to hear from the descending process. If, in fact, our understanding of reality is that we're not seeing it with material eyes, material senses. And not only, and this is also recognized in Western philosophy, not only are we not connecting with whatever is actually out there, but we're also not connecting with the actual person who's perceiving what's there. The self or the soul is also beyond our ken. Ken, K-E-N. It means your scope of vision, your understanding, scope of vision. It's beyond our purview. It's beyond the scope of our knowledge and perception. Us, who I am. That's why self-realization is like, it's like kind of exalted. Someone tries to understand what or who I really am. People come to the Krishna consciousness, hey, guess what? We're not these bodies. And some people say, well, if I'm not this body, then whose body am I? People don't understand. No, but every once in a while, there's somebody that says, wow, no one ever told me that before. That's amazing. You go to the Catholic or to the Western, and they say, yes, we are spirit soul, and we're also these bodies. That is the theology. Go figure. But when someone comes out and just says it, I was arguing with a Jewish man. He followed me to. He found out that I was a Jewish, from a Jewish tribe, and he wouldn't let go of me. It was a small group of aggressive Jewish people in New York in the early 80s, and he followed me all the way to the temple, and he wanted to preach to me. He wanted me to eat special Jewish bread called matzah. And I said, well, I'll take some. Let me first offer it to Krishna. Doesn't have any eggs, does it? No, no eggs. And then when I suggested I'm going to offer it to Krishna, he said, oh, okay, well, forget that. Let's try something else. So we started talking philosophy. And I said to him, I said, imitating, he could do that pretty easily, imitating his Jewish cadence. And I, way of talking. And so I said, so, this body is temporary. Yes. And the soul is eternal. Yes. I said, so therefore, we are not these bodies. I said to him. He looked at me and said, well, I wouldn't go so far as to put it like that. Prabhupada didn't mince words. We're not these bodies, but sometimes Western philosophies catch that. I always like to mention Malebranche after Descartes. He says, we have nothing to do with these bodies. Because he was trying to deal with the very different, and these verses here have something to do with it. How does spirit interact with matter? Is a big problem for philosophers. To try to explain that, and the Descartesian dualism that there's mind and body, or that there's spirit and matter, created even when they were still a little pious, and they trying to explain how could God be divided in two, a big problem trying to deal with that. Spinoza had a pantheistic solution: just God is. There is no two, there's only one, it's all one, like pantheism. But Malebranche, he got it. How did he get it? I don't know. He must have been a little pious. He said, maybe even ate meat, but somehow he was pious. He said that we have nothing to do with these bodies. So how do you explain, how do we interact, how do I make this hand move? Guess what? You're not doing it. Guess what? We're not the doers. How is it done? God is doing it. I want to move my hand, I'm not moving my hand. I have the desire. I mean, computers move so fast. What to speak of God? I mean, you think God is not as fast as a supercomputer? Admit, I have the desire, and he wants to, he still deserves to move. If you don't deserve it, paralysis. Well, you call it whatever you want, but he won't let you move it. You see? Sometimes some people have nerve disease. I had it. A very dear friend who just passed away, and he got very severe his Parkinson's disease. So there's reasons external, but the real thing is that Krishna's, for one reason or another, he's not permitting it to happen. In the case of a great devotee, who could understand? So anyway, these are some ideas here. The vision provided by Arjuna. We had earlier in the chapter. We had also. Another idea of being provided is Premanjana Chari is very elevated, but on a lesser platform, still very exalted because it's directly dealing with Krishna. Natumam Shakyase Drashtum Ananya Vaisva Chakshusha Divyam Dadami Ti Chakshu Pasyami Yoga Maishvara. He says, oh Arjuna, yes, I'll show you this universal form, but you can't see it with your present eyes, so I'll give you divine eyes. Behold my mystic opulence. And then Krishna also allowed the demigods. Sometimes it's described, that's demigod vision. They already have that. But here it's described that Krishna also gave the demigods the ability to see. That's why we hear in subsequent verses after 19, when the destructive time factor enters into the picture, that even the demigods were very disturbed and bewildered, even in the upper planetary systems, Java Pratibhudur, Idamantaram, he and all that, towards the beginning of the chapter. Hare Krishna. So that was now, sometimes it's commented that that divine vision to see the universal form, in a way it was a step down for Arjuna. Because he was, his abhista, his innermost desire, and his rasa with Krishna was one of friendship. And seeing the Somyavapu all the time. In fact, Krishna became the servant of the Pandavas. He became their messenger. He did so many things for the Pandavas, protected them in so many ways. Queen Kunti recognized them. In the next text, is interesting idea here. This Prabhupada's referring to mistaken commentators on the Bhagavad Gita, and as he does many times, he's alluding to Dr. Radha Krishna, who was the president of India and a great scholar. And Prabhupada actually used his translations were okay, they weren't bad, but the purports were, the commentary was a disaster, especially to 934. Excuse me, Man Manabhava Madbhakto Madhyaji Man Namaskaru, that verse, and you know the story, how he said, it's not to actually the person Krishna, but it's the unborn within Krishna to whom we have to surrender. Thank you, Mr. Dr. Radha Krishna. You would have been better off as a foot doctor instead of a doctor of Shastra or philosophy. So Prabhupada would often refer to that as how misleading commentary. Bhagavad Gita without Krishna, what kind of Bhagavad Gita is that? So, there, when I took Bhakti Shastri course in 2003, I was already 10 years ago, in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, sorry. The teacher was a young man. We had some social problem because I was so senior to him in age and years in ISKCON, and he was young enough to be my son. And yet, I was a student and he was a teacher, and as usual, I was too boisterous and over-contributor in the class. And so he came up to see me and he said, I don't know what to do with you. I can't chastise you, but I don't know how to deal with it. You speak so much. Also, I had a little different realization than he did. But basically, he was really good. He later joined a group of devotees from Boston and became absorbed in Harvard Sanskrit study, along with Jivan Mukta and a couple of others. I hope they're still, you know, chanting their rounds. I think they are. Oh, I didn't tell you his name. Vrindavan Das Thakur, Das Prabhu. So he used an academic who would very, very elaborate work on the Bhagavad Gita, where he quotes commentators both ancient and modern. He quotes a lot of the same commentators that we quote and that we hear about, and he also quotes more modern ones. And his name is Robert Minor. Now, interesting. Why did the Bhakti Shastri teacher in ISKCON use an academic? It wasn't the main source, but he would refer to him a lot. Because he was really staunch personalist. He really stood up to the Advaitavad, to the Mayavad. He really was convinced that Krishna is a person. So that kind of gave him some ISKCON socially redeeming value, you can say. I hope. Maybe this is an omen. Anyway, he said something very interesting and very telling. And this is not like Dr. Radha Krishna. This is not demoniac. It's kind of innocent. We can say, kind of immature understanding. But here is this great scholar. Each verse he's quoting sometimes as many as 15 different commentators on the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, it's a very exhaustive study. There's a word for it. I can't remember it right now. That type of study. And he gets to the end of the 11th chapter, going into the 12th chapter, which is going to happen here pretty soon. And he says, many commentators cannot understand. It's like a big letdown. You get to the epiphany and the exalted full revelation of the majesty of the universal form, and then all of a sudden they start talking about these almost domestic concerns. You know, Arjuna says, what's more important, the personal or the impersonal? And I mean, you know, what a letdown. He would have liked to see perhaps the Bhagavad Gita end at the end of the 11th chapter, or not quite at the end, maybe before Krishna reverted into his, quote, lesser, more prosaic, human-like form. Because his paradigm was that God is great, and what could be greater than the universal form? He thought that was the ultimate revelation. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'll just leave out a few other of my well, you don't know what I still have here. Then you'll get the blame when it gets to be 8:30. And there's a verse that kind of connects in different ways with this presentation. It has to do with epistemology in terms of paradigms. What is paradigm? Paradigm means the lens by which you see the world. It means your worldview. It means your underlying assumptions that you might not even know you have. You may not be able to articulate them. You might not even be aware of your underlying assumptions. For instance, a paradigm of modern science is simply that life comes from matter. And not only science, but it extends into philosophy. You get great thinkers that really respect the dignity of human life. They understand there is such a thing as a self, there is such a thing as consciousness, but they're putting it in a Procrustean bed. That means they're trying to artificially fit it into the Darwinian paradigm, because Darwin rules at the current time, especially in the Western world. Not as much in Poland as in many other countries, but Darwin is too influential. So that's a paradigm. Paradigms. Scientific revolution, change of paradigms. It's not easy to change someone's paradigms, and that's why preaching is not always so easy, because we have to... I'm going to give some examples, but there's no time. So, in the 10th canto, you can try this verse on for size, as we say. There's a list of 10 different paradigms, Hare Krishna, 10 different paradigms of 10 different groups of people. Now, paradigms are not all relative, as Ravindra Sarup Prabhu points out. There's the preferred paradigm, which is the Krishna paradigm. In other words, Vedic culture and Vaishnava Siddhanta, this paradigm has some elite status, you might say. And in that, with Krishna at the center, there is actually scope for varied paradigms, and they're all true. And what is the example? The example is when Krishna and Balaram entered the wrestling arena of Kamsa. Many of you are familiar with this verse. There are 10 different paradigms given. People saw Krishna in 10 different ways. Malanam Ashanir. Malanam is the wrestlers. What do they see Krishna? As a lightning bolt. Well, that's not wrong. Krishna says, Ayudhanam Aham Vajram, weapons I am the lightning bolt, in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 10. And then the men who were present there, they saw him as Dinam Nara Varam. They saw him as the best of men. And then the ladies, Srinam Smaro Murtiman. They saw him as Smaro. I just got an email from Satyaraj Prabhu. And he wants to, he's thinking about, maybe this is a secret, don't tell anybody, but he's thinking about writing a work on Cupid. And he's asking some of us if that's appropriate, will people get the wrong idea, but we do hear about Cupid. And here's one place we hear about him, Smara. Smara is Cupid. Muktiman is the incarnation of Cupid. That's how the Srinam, that's how the ladies saw Krishna and Balaram entering the wrestling arena. That's not so difficult to understand. And then Gopanam, Svajana, the cowherd men, they saw him as Svajana, is a homeboy, like one of this our village boys. They're great, but they're one of us. They're from our village. Gopinath, the cowherd men, they saw him as one of their own. Yeah, Krishna was also a cowherd boy. And then Gopanam, Svajano, and Shatam. Shatam means Asatam, the impious, the wicked, Shiti, Bujo, the rulers of the world, saw him as Shashta. Shashta, what is Shashta? Chastisement. Shashta is a chastiser. He saw, we're gonna get whipped. They could see that. Pretty good. And then what is it? Svapitro Shishua. That his parents saw him as little baby boys. Little boys, too frail. How can they wrestle with his mustika and chanura, these big, you see that one picture of them, their muscles are practically breaking out of their cloth. I mean, they're just like giant iron men. And it goes on, Mrityur, Bhojapater, who's Kamsa, saw them very correctly as death. And that's not wrong either. And here's the, where it gets touchy, and with all due respects to Mr. Minor, he's, you know, better than an ordinary mundane philosopher. It says, Virad Avidusham. The unintelligent saw him as the universal form. I don't know if Mr. Minor is still with us, but I would behoove him to read this verse from Bhagavad Purana. He might blush a little bit, because he does accept scripture. And then it goes on that param tadvam yoginam. It's another paradigm. The yogis, they see Krishna and Balaram. Oh, here is param tadvam. Here's the absolute truth. And then that's not wrong either. And then what happens next? Vrishninam paradeva. The Vrishnis, they saw Krishna and Balaram as their worshipful deity. Vrishninam paradeva teti vidito rangam gata sagrachaha. And as an inducement to at least look a little bit into Sanskrit, that word sagrachaha is three words in one. Sa, agra, ja. And in a not totally literal translation, but a valid translation, it means his older brother. With, sa, agra, first, ja, born. With his first, well, who was born first. So that's Balaram. So when Krishna and Balaram entered the wrestling arena, different groups of... we're going back to previous microphone problems. No, it's okay. They all saw him from their own paradigms. But in the case of Krishna, it's okay, because it's all correct. It doesn't mean you could just invent anything. But their ways of seeing Krishna were all valid. And it all worked. And they were all in their own bhav, in their own mood. But much worse than that is when one, as Prabhupada is criticizing it, the purport to the second verse in 51, is the, like Radha, Dr. Radha Krishna, is when one thinks that Krishna is not real. The forearm form is real. The two-hour form is real. Chaturbhuj, real. Somyavapu, real. There used to be an advertisement, it was either for Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. Was it Coca-Cola? It said, it's the real thing. Lie. Not real. It's bogus. It's Kali Yuga. Give me one second. Worse than that, the worst thing is when the Mayavad, when they say that, when Brahman gets infected by the mode of goodness, he becomes Ishvara. So it's mayika. It's not real. In other words, everything's mixed up. Like religion and the mode of passion sometimes often mistakes real religion for irreligion. Intelligence and the mode of ignorance gets it wrong every time. They always take irreligion as religion and religion as irreligion. It may not seem like a great difference, but it gets worse as you go down. So the worst thing is like that. In the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there's a famous Abhijananti Mamuda Tanun Manusim Tanu Mashritaha Palamba Bama Chananto Mamad Bhuta Maheshram. Fools deride me. They jeer. They make fun of me. When I descend in a human-like form, they do not understand my real position, my supreme position. Mm. And then in the next verse, moga sa moga karmano, moga jnana vicheta sa, etc. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada quotes a very strong verse from the Vishnu... here it is. Brihad Vishnu Smriti. Yoveti bhoti kam deham krishna sya paramatmanaha sasarva smad bahis karyaha shrauta smarta vidanataha mukam tasya evalokyati sa chelam snanam acharet. One who considers the body of Krishna to be material should be immediately driven out from all functions of Shruti and Smriti. In other words, all yajnas, all sacrifices, all incantations of the Vedic mantras should be driven out with sticks. And if one just happens to see the face of such a person, you should immediately jump in the Ganga or Yamuna, if you can find a Yamuna. You jump in and to purify yourself of contamination. That gets that bad if one makes that mistake. Again, it gets back to the philosophical problem. How does spirit interact with matter? How does God deal with the material world? And many religionists feel he doesn't. He just creates it somehow or another, and then he stands back and watches it go and has nothing to do with it. Then it just works by its own laws, like a big clock or a watch. And others, they try to solve the problem by saying there aren't two, there's only one. Everything is one. So Vaishnava understanding, especially in our lane, is Satya Veda, Aveda Tattva. There's Paramatma, there's Bhagavan, there's different aspects of God. Some are more non-different and some are more different from this world. But Krishna doesn't have any problem. He could, if he wanted to, he could walk right through that door right now and come down and sit down here and start laughing or start playing his flute. If that happens, I excuse you for not listening to this class anymore. I think that would be all right. He could do it. He could come into this world. Of course, this is the spiritual world. Here we are in Sri Vrindavan Dham. But even if you go to Brooklyn, New York, or some crazy place like that, Prabhupada told the devotees, this is not New York, this is Vaikuntha. If you hear the deities, he's chanting Hare Krishna and invoking. So basically, we discussed a little bit some philosophical points, and not to depend on our imperfect senses or our mental speculation to understand what is real, what is not real, who I am. Life come from matter, or does matter come from life? In other words, does life come from life? To understand these questions, is there such a thing? Someone was just telling me today that there's an active effort being made in science again to try to overcome death by science. Who is telling me? Someone here? They're at it again. They were trying to turn off the aging switch for the genes. And the people who are trying to do that, they died. So then, the next generation, it's like me when I forget to take my memory medicine. And then the next generation, they're now they're again at it, again. They hope they can win the race. And so how do we know? How do we know? And I was a hippie. Yes, my friends, I used to be a hippie. It's a special mercy case of Prabhupada that I'm allowed to be in this Hare Krishna movement. A man came up to me, it was like a wizard, he had a big white beard, it wasn't Santa Claus. He came up to me and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "How do you know that you're going to die? You don't really know that." And I became very ecstatic. I said, "Yeah, maybe I'll live forever. Why not?" Yeah. Oh, you remember Gandalf from Boston? This is 1966. So, actually, you don't really know. You know, I mean, you can't say because, we haven't examined all the men in the world. We don't know. Maybe someone's immortal. Maybe I can be immortal and live forever in this body. So how do we know? The Bible tells me so. And what's our Bible? Bhagavad Gita. Chatasi hi dhruvo mityur dhruvam jama matasya chapas. There's no. Thank you. You said you're welcome. Some of these demigods, they have a real sense of humor, you know. Hare Krishna. Or maybe someone's out there playing with the switches, I don't know. I didn't arrange this, believe me. Oh, that's what they're called? Monkeys. Monkeys. From monkey to monk. That's my history. So, this is not to be known by sense perception and mental speculation. All men are mortal. We don't know that, but we know it because Krishna said it. So simple. And, well, how do you know that Krishna is... Well, it's okay. It's okay. You don't have to jump to a conclusion. You know, study Krishna a little bit. Try chanting his name. Oh, no, I'm not going to chant his name. All right, well, then read the book. All right, give me the book. So, you know, then little by little one can start to feel more at home with Krishna and go back to home, back to Godhead. Thank you very much for your kind attention. It's a little overtime, only about 3 minutes overtime, so we can sneak in. And anyone has a question, please. Mother Parvati.
Okay, because my understanding of the words ontological and epistemological aren't too thorough as yours, and you have referred to 2:16 as the ontological verse of the Bhagavad Gita, but Srila Prabhupada refers to the essence of the Bhagavad Gita in his purport to 11:55. Which translates, "My dear Arjuna, one who is engaged in my pure devotional service, free from the contaminations of previous activities and from mental speculation, and who is friendly to every living entity, certainly comes to me." So in the purport, a few lines down, Prabhupada says, "This verse is considered to be the essence of Bhagavad Gita." So how does that relate to what you have describe you and Acharya quoted that verse 2:16 as ontological?
Now, I'm not claiming that 2:16 is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita.
What is that?
That's almost kid stuff compared to other topics which are covered in Bhagavad Gita. It's like we're not going to say that we're not these bodies. That's the essence of Bhagavad Gita. That's like entry level Vedic knowledge. That's why Krishna only gets into it one time, doesn't even go back to it in the whole Bhagavad Gita. Even in the 18th chapter. All I'm saying is that that whole study of that philosophical department called ontology is covered by that verse, 2:16. I didn't go further than that. I didn't say 2:16 is the central point of the whole Bhagavad Gita. You can say the essence of Bhagavad Gita, as Prabhupada says, is 1855, is it? Or 54? I mean 11:55, but then what about 9:34 and 1865 and 1866? So there are a few verses which are right. Okay, yeah, it's confidential, more confidential, and most confidential. Yeah, well, you're going to get to that soon. Be patient. In a couple of days, the glories of that verse will be fully expounded in this arena. All right, well, when we say something is, what do we mean by that? What does it mean to exist? And all I'm saying, maybe I didn't spell it out, but in 216, yeah, the study of existence, what does it mean? Well, that's one answer to it. And according to Bhagavad Gita, it's the answer. In other words, it's so clear. Krishna makes it so clear, especially in Prabhupada's presentation, that the criterion for something to be real or not real is that if it's real, it doesn't change. In other words, not just a temporary configuration of energy. Yeah, the study of studying, what do we mean by existence? What do we mean by real? Sariputta refers to the Absolute Truth as a ground reality. In other words, what's the basis? Krishna says, I am the basis in 9.18. So the solution to all these ontological studies, all this study of existence, is right there, not even in the whole verse, just the first two lines. That which is real is not changing. That which is real is eternal. And if it's going to end, it doesn't matter if it's going to end even in a trillion years from now. It's still not quite real. That's why in the very first verse, the universe is described as almost real. But even the demigods are confused. Now, do we think that this world is real or not real? Well, officially, we have to say it's real because we're following Madhvacharya in that line. But there are places, in fact, the very first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, where it says, even the demigods think it's real, although it's unreal. So, in one sense, In a lot of ways, that's what universal form is considered more or less imaginary, because it's temporary. If something is real, then we're talking about Krishna's four-arm form, his two-arm form, and ourselves as spirit souls. Yes, are you for real? Yes, I'm for real, but I'm not this body. Any other questions? Comments? I can't believe, Acharya, you don't have any questions. Come on, yes. Hare Krishna.
Krishna. Does reality also mean that something which exists eternally in the spiritual sky?
Yes. But here in this material world, if there wasn't the presence of some real things, then the material world would have no reason for existing. The material world, of course Krishna arranges the whole thing, but the material world, it's like if there weren't prisoners, there wouldn't be a jail. So prisoners are people, so in one sense you could say they're real. So the whole construction of the jail, which has so many faults, but it's all there because to accommodate the needs of the people that happen to be prisoners. So material world, in other words, not only in the spiritual sky in the material world, there's reality in this material world too. The example given in Srimad Bhagavatam in the chapter on autumn season is the wonderful, wonderful analogy that why is it that false ego seems so real? Why is it like we look at each other speaking? You know, what's making this sound is some bones in the skin bag here. I mean, I don't want to scare you or anything, but it just... You know, ladies, their bones are smaller, so their voice is higher. You know, but there's what's that thing that flaps up and down inside the diaphragm? It's moving in the voice box. It's also the voice box. No, the diaphragm is here, but there's a diaphragm, it's a membrane that's vibrating in the voice box. In other words, it's a machine, folks. This is a machine. But inside all that, there's subtle body and there's actually soul. And so there's actually... So why is it, as the example is given, that when you see the clouds in the sky and they're illuminated, some of you know this example from the autumn season chapter, and they look like the clouds are effulgent. But actually, it's the moon that's effulgent, that's behind the clouds. And at the same time, the clouds are covering the source of the cloud's apparent effulgence. You see how beautifully this analogy works? So in the same way, the false ego is covering the source of its own apparent reality. In the material world, everybody's got it wrong. That's why they can't figure out how to solve the socio-political mess that's going on. And that's why the economic, and nothing's working. Because they don't know, they think that they're being convinced by Krishna's Maya, Shakti. They're being convinced that false ego based on